Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Friday, November 17th, 2017, starting at 4:11 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 133rd episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Adam Ellenboss, and we're going to be going through and answering some questions that were submitted by listeners of the podcast over the past couple of months. Hey, Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on again. So I was going to do a Q&A episode a couple of months ago, or at least towards the end of September. I was kind of scrambling to come up with an episode due to cancellation, and I put out a call for questions just to see if there would be any good ones for a Q&A episode. And I actually got a ton of them, and me and Adam Summer started to do a Q&A episode early last month, but we got to the first question and it was actually such an interesting question that we decided to focus the entire episode on that topic, which was the nodes, which, you know, as I'm sure you know, are something that you could talk about quite a bit, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I took in that episode. It was really interesting conversation you guys had.
Yeah. And I was kind of okay at the time, you know, letting it go and turn into just a single topic episode, just because it was such an interesting and important topic and discussion to have. But then I felt bad that there was so many questions that listeners had submitted that I didn't get a chance to answer. And I thought you would actually be a good person to talk to about some of these, because your approach is very similar to mine in some ways. And a lot of the questions that my listeners submitted were more almost sort of designed or directed specifically at me. So I thought you'd be a good person to talk to for these.
Yeah, that sounds like a good deal. And, you know, obviously the practical application questions about Hellenistic astrology are, it's right in my wheelhouse. I love those kinds of questions.
Right, exactly. So both you and I have had that experience of starting out as, you know, purely modern astrologers and then becoming interested in traditional astrology and studying that tradition or those traditions, and then attempting to sort of move back more towards somewhere in the middle in between those two extremes, let's say, I think. And so in that way, we're very similar as well.
Yeah, totally. I think, I've sort of lovingly titled the online program that I teach Ancient Astrology for Modern Times, because I find a lot of useful concepts in modern astrology. I'm not ready to throw them out or anything. So, but I, like you, I also feel like the study of classical forms of astrology, Hellenistic astrology in particular, has completely enlivened and revolutionized my practice. So I'm really passionate about trying to, build bridges for people just like you are doing.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And that was, you know, at the end of my book, that was a point, because I was talking to somebody about this recently and I wasn't sure. They were surprised on some level that I was saying there was more to astrology than just Hellenistic astrology. While I'm a huge proponent of that, and that's what I've come to specialize in, you know, I tried to end the conclusion of my book with a statement that, you know, the point is not to go back to the ancient sources and just stay there. And while you could develop and use a type of astrology that's perfectly legitimate and effective and useful, there's something to be said by going back into the tradition, finding the best parts, and then bringing them forward into modern times and merging those with some of the good developments that happened over the past 2,000 years. And I feel like that's a place that a lot of us end up coming to sort of naturally, but sometimes, you know, it's hard to walk that line between promoting your interest in ancient astrology versus still saying, you know, but that's not to say that there's not anything good in modern astrology that you still should pay attention to.
Right. It's also not the same as saying that I also see a kind of a disturbing trend in social media. Some of the debates that I follow, which I don't have the stomach to participate in them as much as I used to. But I'll see this trend sometimes where people will say, well, there's really no distinctions between these eras of astrology. The eras are subjective. They're made up by, you know, people who are more like, you know, historical, academic, astrologers back then, astrologers today, it all works. And that kind of thinking, I think, I've had to also sort of solidly reject, because I think that the distinctions are, they're defined enough that it's really worth looking into. So, I think it's also important to make sure that what we're not saying is like, yeah, we're trying to create some kind of complete synthesis or union between the two either.
Yeah, not creating sort of like a hodgepodge or something like that, but instead trying to do something that's sort of careful and well thought out.
Yeah, exactly. I think Lisa's talk at Nightlight this week demonstrating the usefulness of a more modern concept like the Saturn return, but then incorporating sect status of Saturn into the delineation of a Saturn return is a great example of the kind of thoughtful synthesis that's not just learn ancient astrology, and then if you kind of come back to modern astrology, you'll see that there's some grand synthesis that exists. There are some distinctions that just don't work together too, and it's important to look at those.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that concept of sect has always been one of my favorites because that's a great example of, something in modern astrology where that really was one of the core things that was like the philosophical or conceptual premise that astrologers in like the 60s and 70s and 80s used for rejecting the distinction between benefic and malefic as a concept, is they would say, look, there's people that go through their Saturn returns, between the ages of 27 and 30, and one person has a very constructive experience of that time, and another person has a very difficult or traumatic experience of that time. And that shows that, this distinction that the malefics are not always malefic, and therefore we should reject any such distinction. But then you go back to ancient astrology and you find that there were sometimes actually techniques that could help to specify or clarify when something like a malefic transit or a malefic planet like Saturn, when it would be experienced in a more difficult way versus a more positive way, and that there's ways to actually figure that out from a technical standpoint, and you don't have to sort of obliterate the whole distinction just because of a sort of incomplete understanding of it.
Right. Yeah, that's a great example.
Sure. All right. Well, so why don't we transition into some of these questions, because we actually got a ton of really good ones. And the first set of questions comes from a listener. These were all submitted by patrons of the Astrology Podcast over the past couple of months. So generally people that have been listening to the show for a while. And one of them comes from Michael Beeson. And his first question is, he asks, what are the mistakes that most beginners make when they start to learn astrology? I know you've had a number of students over the years, and you've been teaching through your school Nightlight astrology for a while. What are some of the mistakes that you think that beginners make when they first start learning the subject?
There's a few. I think one of them is, I think that beginners can get frustrated with the language acquisition process. So when you're learning astrology, a simple analogy is that it's like learning a foreign language. You don't learn a foreign language, as far as I've, my own experience has been, you don't learn a foreign language just by studying, grammar and syntax, and you don't just learn from textbooks. That's a part of the learning, but I'll never forget, in graduate school taking Spanish classes, and that experience compared to being thrown in over my head in Peru into a Spanish-speaking country, there's a lot that you learn, just by osmosis and just being in the mix of that kind of, the people who actually speak the language. I think that something similar is happening in astrological education, where there's a certain amount of material that you have to memorize, that you have to know the concepts that are important to understand, basic memorization and things like that. But then the actual process of delineating charts, of becoming, well, I would just say becoming a diviner, becoming a reader, I think that that's a process of language acquisition that takes a long time. So learning how concepts are used, how they're used artfully, how the language of astrology becomes intuitive. You have to have a lot of patience, and you have to love astrology more than you are impatient that you can't do astrology as well as you believe it can be done in the beginning. I think that's actually like a huge deal, because I see students in my programs all the time that, you know, by the time you've gone through, you know, planets, houses, signs, aspects, essential dignity, accidental dignity, you know, you go through all of these things and you're not even touched the outer planets or lots or asteroids or all the other, you know, amazing amount of material that's out there. A student will either get, you know, paralysis by analysis. They'll get frozen, not knowing which technique to use or how to use all of them or which ones to use together. So they just get frozen, or they'll feel like astrology is too complicated, or it can, or, you know, it can just say anything you want it to say because there's so many techniques that you can just bend them, you know, and massage the chart to get it to say what you want. So they lose a sense of astrology being something that can communicate objectively and effectively and things like that. But a lot of it is not due to the fault of astrological theory as much as it is to the process of learning. I mean, traditionally, as far as I've understood, and, you know, apprenticeships of most kinds in the ancient world likely would have been lasting for many, many, many years. I can say that from having worked in shamanic traditions in the Amazon, where for, you know, a decade of my life, I studied with shamans whose apprenticeships were 20, 30 years long. I think that was probably much more common in the ancient world. And even people like, you know, you or myself, who are seeing clients pretty often and really immersed in the material, I think, you know, both of us would probably say that a lot of concepts don't become really clear through anything but being immersed in the language, study, and practice of astrology over a long period of time. So I think, I could put it really simply and just say the number one obstacle most beginners make is not being patient enough with the language acquisition process.
Yeah, definitely. And realizing that it's a long-term process. I mean, that brings up a lot of thoughts for me, actually. I mean, one of them, which is, what is the astrological equivalent of language immersion? And I'm having difficulty thinking of anything other than basically just reading charts for people and doing consultations. But that brings up one of the classic catch-22s for newer astrologers and for prospective, eventually, like, you know, professional astrologers, is that at some point it's like you have to make this transition into, you know, seeing clients or doing astrology readings for other people, but nobody ever quite gets to that point where they feel like they've fully mastered astrology before they start doing that, because astrology is like this lifelong subject. But in order to get the mastery, you actually have to start seeing the clients in order to see the principles in practice, because there's something about the way that astrology comes alive when you're hearing a person talk about their own life that gives you a deeper understanding of the principles working in action than anything you could ever read in a book. But there's this weird middle ground for all astrologers of, you know, having to make that leap into starting to see clients, even though you might not feel fully a master of the subject quite yet.
Yeah, that's, I completely hear you. In fact, well, there's two things that I would want to say in response. One is that I think it's archetypal. I this is the modern astrologer in me anyway, that I think the situation that we run into is, there are concerns about like not doing any harm to people because you're a beginner, and that's right. Very legitimate. But I think on some level, it's like, I think of the old classic Disney film Fantasia, and, you know, the Mickey Mouse is the sorcerer's apprentice. And he gets a hold of the basically the sorcerer's magic, when the sorcerer is away, and, you know, basically makes a complete mess out of everything. And I feel like there's something about the situation that we're in as astrologers that are in some ways, and this is why I think Hellenistic astrology and traditional astrology is so important. It's not just the concepts, it's not just the techniques. Oh, they work better, even though I actually believe they do work better in many cases. It's actually that there's a sense of lineage. There's a psychological dimension of there actually being a sorcerer somewhere nearby. When you study ancient astrology, there's a psychological presence, and you can feel the magicians, the archetype of Hermes. You feel this this spiritual presence, I would even call it, of masters or masterful people, or a tradition of lengthier time and space and apprenticeship than we currently have available. It sort of psychologically becomes a part of your experience. And I think that as vague as that might sound, I think it's actually really, really valuable, because it there's a kind of accountability that starts to get entrained in your body and your mind in some way. You become a little bit like a Stoic or a Platonist or even a yogi if you're, you know, studying a little bit of Indian astrology or something. It comes into you a little bit. And then I think that the situation of, like, you know, having to wave the wand around all the masters away, it becomes more productive, because you at least have a sense that there is a master, you know, waiting, maybe ready to scold you or maybe to praise your work. But I think that the presence of that is there in traditional astrology. Certainly people can take it to an extreme and start worshiping at the altar of the past and get a big ego about it, you know, or think that, you know, they're some elevated master themselves. And that's not what I'm talking about. But the other thing that I wanted to mention was, I think it's also normal, even if you do have a great teacher, to need to, teachers and students have classically throughout history, I think it's also very archetypal for teachers and students to need to reject one another at some point and to go off on their own and to make mistakes and to, or to lovingly be pushed out of the nest or something like that. And I think, for example, I think that kind of happened with Robert Schmidt, who has this huge, I think, creates a sort of renaissance in astrology through a lot of his translation work. I mean, I know there are others too, but he's this pivotal figure. And a lot of his students, and I know, you know, like you were there, you were living there, Dimitro, George was there. There's a lot of Joseph Crane, all these people that come out of being really inspired by him. But there's also this tension that exists between, you know, the stories of how these people have gone off to become disseminators of Hellenistic astrology and how that separation occurred. That's not, you know, it's not easy for everybody that tells the story. And certainly when I visited with Robert, it, you know, I could feel the sensitivity that he had around that same topic of being someone who's sort of like the discoverer of this, but then, and like wanting people to go off and keep thinking and doing work, but then being, you know, suspicious about whether people are doing it the right way. Or so I think that tension that exists it's with us on a psychological level, whether or not we have any masterful teacher that we can name. And so I think that, like I said, Hellenistic astrology actually provides us with a sense of there being a master in the room, because it's filled with the disciplic succession model where, compilers in the first couple of, you know, centuries of the Common Era are quoting the founders, and their source texts are called upon in an almost scriptural way. And I think when you really immerse yourself in that, it gives you a sense of something holding you accountable. But in my school, the way that I've sought to address that problem, it's a 1-year program that I teach. And at first in the program, the way that I tried to address it, because I was trying to address my own problem with the exact issue that you mentioned of, it's this catch-22. You're trying to get experience, but you don't have experience. So how could you presume to go and do this? Right. So I think on one level, you just have to be audacious and and kind of crazy, and that's okay. But I thought to myself, well, what if I created a program where, you know, first 6 months we study all the core theory, and then in the second 6 months I have the students read in groups for clients. And then we do workshopping, because I came from an MFA in creative writing where, you know, we wrote our creative pieces and then workshopped them in the group. So what if we had a kind of group dynamic where we workshopped each other's readings for other people, and maybe that would create that feeling of accountability and that the benefit of experience all at once? Well, that did not work at all. It was actually really counterproductive, because there would be always in the class a few people who were totally ready. And then, you know, a good majority of people who just were not totally equipped to read for other people. Wonderful hearts, I think, understanding astrology, but for one reason or another, just not totally ready for it. And so then I was like, okay, well, I can't, it doesn't make sense for me to waste so much time. And it didn't feel right to bring clients in who really were not getting a good, I don't think they were getting a good astrological experience. So here I am, I'm like, okay, well, let's think about this again. Somehow I've come into a space through sort of audaciousness that I've been able to practice for other people at some point, just go out on a limb. I started with friends and things like that, acquaintances, and being very cautious about what I said and did and trying to keep it really simple. But, you know, I gained confidence along that path. And what I noticed was that a lot of other astrologers who were being called to actually practice for other people through my programs were naturally just being able to take the material and go forth and put it to use. The ones who I didn't think should, but we're going to go try to do so anyway, I wasn't going to stop. In fact, would lose any opportunity that I had to continue teaching them if I tried to address it most of the time. And so then I created a new model. This is what I'm currently using, which is to have people in the first 6 months, we study all the core Hellenistic theory. And compare comparative with modern theory. And then in the second 6 months, I read for people, and the students watch the readings of a live client in the classroom. And the client knows in advance, of course, they're coming into a classroom and so forth. And the client can be anonymous if they'd like. They're just, their audio is there. They're talking to me, and nobody in the classroom is commenting. They're only observing. And then we, having studied the chart, having had a reading, and then we break it down afterward. And I found that I think there needs to be more of that in astrology, where people who have somehow found their way into a healthy and productive practice, they've navigated that catch-22 somehow, where they've had a great teacher that really, you know, baby stepped them into things. Those are the people who need to be teaching their students through, you know, the live hands-on experience. I think we need more of us astrologers who are educators to say, okay, my method is I'm not so protective of how I work that I can't allow my students to see it. Because what I experienced as astrologers in my early studies was that for whatever reason, it seemed like astrologers were really protective of demonstrating their readings in front of a group of people. And I actually think that's part of a general culture in modern astrology that says, you know, don't let anybody know that you're sort of making it up as you go, or don't let anybody know that, you know, you're don't let them see your method because they might steal it, or I don't know, other reasons. But if you're practicing Hellenistic astrology or traditional astrology, the great thing is that you should be using enough repeatable methods and techniques within a consistent framework that you're not just making things up, and you don't have some super idiosyncratic method that someone could steal. So anyway, I'll leave it at that, but there's a lot more, I'm sure, that, you know, could be said on all this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a tendency in traditional astrology to have a little bit more of a defined method so that it's clear if somebody asked you, where you could say, these are the principles, or these are the specific interpretive steps that I was taking that I apply to every chart, and this is why I was making this specific statement or what have you.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what led to the transition that I made in my course. Was I was having, when I was studying modern astrology, my courses were all about, you know, trying to give students the experience of reading for others. And it, by no design, when I started studying Hellenistic astrology, my readings became, you know, more concise, more specific. I think my methods became much more refined. And then reading for other people, I also was able to, you know, kind of break down what I did step by step in repeatable ways. And then, you know, being able to give students that. I think Demetra is really, really great at that too. I mean, she really comes to my mind as someone who, her book, Astrology and the Authentic Self, I think that has some really great, I think, just like simple, like she has that good crossover for modern astrologers, where you have some really simple methods, like how to look at the sun, moon, and rising, you know, which I think a lot of modern astrologers are familiar with. But you could, when you take that and then you add in an evaluation of configurations and sect and a lot of other things, suddenly you get a much more specific picture, and you have a really repeatable method.
Right. Yeah. She actually just sent me the cover of her book. Her next book is going to be even better. It's I'm spacing out on the title, but it's basically a traditional version of her previous workbook, which was Astrology for Yourself. But she's doing it from a Hellenistic standpoint, and it's going to be a really good book in terms of outlining that approach and methodology.
Yeah, I think I really do think that we need a little bit more of that. I know that everyone is an artist, and you know, and everyone has their own intuitions and things like that. But I actually think that I mean, this is my philosophy speaking, but I feel like one of the most important things about having methodology, I'm not suggesting only one methodology, but having repeatable, consistent methodologies is that, well, there's a lot of reasons, but I think one of them for me philosophically is that I want to make my client, I want them to get some objective distance between the fated, or what I would call, because I'm a student of yoga philosophy, I would call karmic circumstances of their life, the material circumstances, so that they can gain some distance from them. So that they can say, like, you know, I'm thinking of quotes from in the West from Valens and Firmicus and others, which I think you put out in your book in a really nice way. They basically say, you know, the soul is not impressed by the ups and downs of fortune. And in order to get into that perspective that of the soul, that's not the happiness and wealth of the soul is not dictated by whether you get a profession or whether maybe a grandparent passes away or things like that. In order to get that distance, I think in all spiritual traditions, you have to gain some sense of the material world as a little bit more predictable, mechanistic, cyclical. Those are all features of my philosophy anyway. So I think that having an approach that you can repeat and that demonstrates more objective or concrete predictive results without losing any of any psychological richness. That to me, that's what my practice has evolved into. So I think, you know, being able to have teachers that can show you demonstrably, like, okay, just for a brief example, I had a woman come into my online classroom not long ago. And we sat down and, you know, we talked about a particular, she wanted to know about relationships. So we were doing a sort of topical analysis and looking at relationships. And I talked about a particular configuration in her chart. And then I was able to say, okay, let's look at a few times in your life where this theme would have been really present already. And I was able to go back and through zodiacal releasing, and through transits, was able to identify a time when she got pregnant and then got engaged, and then during the engagement and pregnancy lost she miscarried and then ended the relationship. And then there were like three others that were all repeated challenging, you know, themes in her relationship life. And I think I never would have been able to be that specific to delineate some aspect of a person's relationship, you know, fate or karma in my philosophy. And then to go back in time and to be able to like zero in on times when it would have been really present and active. So for me, that kind of repeatable, observable practice is also something that needs to be demonstrated for people so that, you know, people can gain the confidence. And because I think there's also a big mistake that beginners make thinking, well, the thing that makes you successful as an astrologer is like sort of on an unconscious level, it's like the power of your personality. Like there's a lot of like cult of personality stuff in astrology where, it, you know, the more persuasive and interesting and like sort of charismatic that you are, you know, sometimes that substitutes for actual like concrete predictive accuracy. And I think that that's a problem too.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, just, there's actually a few things there. I was writing down notes as you were talking, and there's a few points that I wanted to circle back on. So one of them is just, you know, doctors have like residency programs. And I feel like in an ideal world, astrologers would have something like that as well in order to help get them from the point of being completely new to the point of being a practicing astrologer. Is there would be some sort of like oversight phase. And it sounds like that's actually what you tried to set up, although you ran into some issues there in terms of that type of approach, and then instead decided to go more in the direction of demonstrating your approach rather than sort of overseeing the students per se. Is that, am I understanding that right?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I still do think, because that's interesting to me just because you're one of the first people I've heard that says that you've tried that and you feel like it didn't work. I mean, do you feel like then that the residency type model
work? That's a great thing. So right now what I'm doing is during my second year program, in the second 6 months of a second year, people who have stuck around for that long, what I'm doing right now is in the first year, the first 6 months, we work on core basic, you know, doctrines of traditional astrology, and kind of comparing them to modern astrology and seeing how the two kind of compare and what's worth keeping from modern astrology and incorporating things like that. And then in the second 6 months, I read for clients and they get a lot of just hands-on experience seeing the readings done. And I'm encouraging people to, you know, practice on acquaintances and to use very simple methods like reading the house position of the sun, the moon, and the ascendant ruler. And just, you know, trying to, so I give them some models to practice with in a very basic way. But no, we're not even going into any forecasting yet. It's all just how to sit down and read, you know, basic things like the ruler of house seven or planets in house seven for relationships, just and trying to keep it really simple. And then in year two, during the first 6 months, we look at all kinds of prediction methods. So that's where we go into annual perfections, zodiacal releasing, transits, you know, solar returns, progressions, like all sorts of things that we look at in the first 6 months of year two. Mm-hmm. And then in the second 6 months of year two, I do a little bit of demonstrating, and then usually it's a very small group of people who are a lot more dedicated. And so in that second 6 months, then I'm allowing students to read for others and way more successful now because people have been through a year and a half with me and they've gotten to observe a whole bunch. And they've kind of been, you know, it's like in any academic or liberal arts program, try to weed people out through the really tough chem and bio classes for pre-med. I think that that's the same idea that I'm trying to adopt a little bit before I let people take the reins and practice. But then I also have private apprenticeship, and that's really where I'm focused now in terms of trying to build actual astrologers. Because I think that a lot of people come to astrology not necessarily to practice, but to learn, you know, it's almost like a, almost like having a really great version of MapQuest on your phone. You know, having astrology as a navigational tool for your own spiritual journey, I think a lot of people take astrology for that reason. So I think, know, that's totally fine. And then, you know, but a private apprentice, you know, it's one-on-one. I'm talking shop with them in a much more personal and intimate way over the course of 2 years. I won't take apprentices for less than 2 years. So I just, and that has been, I say that the people that I've trained so far who've had the most success, people who are seeing clients and stuff like that, and I think are doing a really good job, have been with me for, you know, 2 years privately one-on-one.
Sure. Okay. So you do are doing just later in your program some version of a sort of residency program?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess my overall point is that I think we, you know, more of us need to do stuff like this. You know, I think because it's not, you know, I think there's people also, it is at the end of the day, it is a craft, and different practitioners bring really unique, you know, elements of the craft to bear on readings. And I'm not going to use the decans in the same way Austin might very brilliantly use them in readings. People should, you know, if they can, they should sit with him and see him read for people. I'm not suggesting Austin take this up. I'm just giving him as an example.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good point, just because that, you know, at Kepler, for example, 10 years ago, when I was in that program, that was one of the issues students ran into, is that they would come out of the school with a lot of book learning, and they would know a lot about like the history and philosophy and the different techniques and the different traditions. They'd be very conversant in, like, you know, being able to switch between like Vedic astrology and medieval astrology and modern astrology and everything else. But then they would have almost zero sort of functional knowledge of how to sit down and do a consultation with a person, because actually sitting down and talking to clients and being able to, you know, do a consultation and the things that are involved in that is a lot different than just knowing astrology sort of in theory.
Yeah. Right.
And that's often the missing piece that a lot of students don't have, like I was saying at the beginning, that for most people, you basically end up just throwing yourself into it at some point, and then you learn as you go. But at some point, I hope the astrological community, and it becomes more common, that there's more of an opportunity for sort of like guiding those transitions through a teacher type figure, so that people can sort of ease into that with a little bit more guidance than they typically have.
Right. It's like, yeah, because at the end of the day, like, what, I mean, you know, most of how we know astrologers in the public is through either their writing or their teaching or their horoscopes or something like that. And I would honestly say that that's usually not a great representation of what a person is like as a reader, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of the greatest astrology teachers are really not as great readers. Some are great at both. And some are better readers than they are teachers. And I think that full range of, it's like, why is it such a secret about how people read? If it were like, no one has a problem writing books about, you know, obscure topics like Black Moon Lilith, but there's a lot fewer like books about methodology and actual client stories and things like that. Or if they are, at least my experience, they were really kind of boring.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is an issue. I mean, part of it's just because modern, you know, contemporary astrology, because it was largely being looked at through the lens of psychology, it became more like a therapy session. And there was almost like you know, people would share and get into very deep stuff about their lives and personal lives. And sometimes that's not something that's open for like public consumption or something like that. And I think that's one of the reasons there was like this privacy sort of orient. That's one of the reasons that there's this privacy orientation towards like not sharing or demonstrating consulting skills. There is also the thing you mentioned where there can be some sensitivity, because perhaps, you know, some astrologers having a lack of structure about the way that they do consultations, and, you know, some maybe, you know, trying to involve intuition or something else like that, that's sort of guiding their consultations rather than having like a structured approach, might be a separate issue. I mean, I know one of the things I have been impressed by that OPA's trying to do is they do these sort of sessions where you have like four astrologers and you practice sort of giving a reading to one of the astrologers in the group, and then the other two watch and then give comments or feedback afterwards. And the astrologer who got the reading gives a feedback afterwards. It's not a completely, perfect system because it's not exactly recreating what a consultation would be like in the field, but it's at least an attempt to, get some comments and some feedback and to show other people what your approach is and maybe get some ideas about things that you could improve.
Yeah. One of my students actually just told me about that. She was present for one of those groups and, she seemed to enjoy it. So yeah, one thing that you said that it just sparked something in my head was the thing about psychological astrology is really interesting. I think this is part of the Renaissance that we were kind of talking about with, modern and traditional forms, sort of this interesting Renaissance of ancient Greek astrology and so forth is, think of Jung, who was, I think, obviously is one of the major figures of modern astrology, even if he's not like, writing books like Dane Rudyar was. Obviously, I think Rudyar was really inspired by Jung for sure. But Jung said something one time, if I remember correctly, it was astrology reflects all of the psychological knowledge of antiquity. And I remember, when I first read that, I was like, oh man, that's so beautiful. But I read that as someone who was, really sort of unconsciously indoctrinated by Jung and his presence within the New Age, the New Age movement. And I think the problem with a statement like that, I actually mentioned this, I was trying to converse with this with Sam Reynolds and Lynn Bell in a recent thread that Sam had on his Facebook wall. But I said, I wonder if there's something about that that's not just sort of co-opting astrology for the purposes of psychology. Because it turns out that astrology is also capable, ancient astrology is also capable of basically offering us insight into the phenomenon of modern psychology. It's also right. The other way around,
and it has it reversed. It has it reversed so that astrology is a subset of psychology, where in fact psychology is actually just like a subset of one of many things that astrology can do.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And I think turning it on its head like that is a part of what this is about. Like, okay, so James Hillman, who I've talked about a lot in the past, he was someone who very similarly noticed that Greek mythology was being co-opted for the sake of basically psychological and sort of clinical diagnosis. So, someone's ill and we say, oh, they have a great mother complex, or someone's ill and they have the Oedipal complex. And so psychological illnesses are mythology is being co-opted for the sake of diagnosing and treating illness. So again, it's still a sort of rational clinical medical model that's co-opting mythology. And Hillman was very sort of irate about that at different moments in his writing, revisioning psychology, which he was nominated for, was it the Pulitzer for, and was all about saying, let's return psychology to myth. So he wanted to, again, he was somewhat similar, wanted to turn it on its head. He believed that the real renaissance of Greek culture within the modern psychological landscape would occur when psychology itself was mythologized. And I think it's very important to understand right now that part of what's happening in this modern renaissance of in astrology is that we are trying to astrologize psychology, or astrologize psychological astrology, or something similar. And I think that process is part of why there's such a secretiveness also about the client setting, because it's easy to objectify methodology. It's like, it's no different from people saying, here's a blog about different ways to treat different herbs to take for, different illnesses or something. Or it's like, dial up WebMD and you can find all the information you want about the body and the illness and different systems and organs and sicknesses and things like that. Or read the DSM-4 or whatever, and you'll find all of the labels for the illnesses. But all of that can only be used by the expertise of the doctor or the psychologist or the therapist. So it's sort of like, you're right, there's a protectiveness around the client dynamic, but it's also a culture. It's sort of an ivory tower academic culture of therapists. And I think that it's prohibitive. And I don't really think it's that mystical or in line with some of what these mystical lineages were about, or how one is initiated into the art form of astrology from the standpoint of therapy, or astrology being used for the sake of therapy. I think that model is a little elitist and exclusive. Even though I think Jungian psychology is really enlightened and interesting, I really love Jung. But I think that one of the reasons that we also need to open up these sessions to show people how readings are done and try to become a little bit more consistent with methodology and things like that is because it's not therapy. And I really believe we're part of this whole renaissance, again, is trying to turn it on its head so that we see psychology as a subset of what astrology is or can do.
Sure. And actually, in line with that, that was a regret that I had about a recent episode where earlier this month we did the Saturn and Sagittarius Saturn return retrospective, which I'd been planning for quite a while to do for at least, I've been talking about it since earlier this year. And I wasn't sure, there were two different approaches I could have taken to do it. One approach was, you know, me getting together a bunch of Saturn return stories and then kind of like summarizing them quickly so I could go through a bunch of them, versus another approach that I thought about wanting to do was do actual interviews with people and then record those and then play the interview of the person talking about their experience and the events that occurred during their Saturn return, and me sort of talking with them about how that related to their chart. And I ended up going with the first method, where me and Lisa and Patrick sat down and just talked about them, and I summarized some, including stories that listeners had sent in to me, and it was great. And we were able to get through 13 of them, which is a lot more than I would have been able to get through the other model. But you really lose something. The one thing that I really regret about doing it that way is remembering or being just fully reminded of the fact that you really lose something when you attempt to describe what happened in the consultation and what you heard from somebody else, and to attempt to summarize their story in a short, like Cliff Notes or bullet point version. You strip out a lot of the nuances and the details and the emotions that are actually conveyed to you in the moment when you're talking directly with a person about their experience of a specific event or transit or what have you in their life. And it's in those moments when you're talking directly to the person about their chart in a consulting setting that the chart really comes alive to you, and you can see the details and the nuances and the subtleties underlying some of the placements. And that's something that you cannot get from a book. You can't get from another astrologer attempting to teach it as an example chart in a class or in a podcast like I did earlier this month. It's like you can only get that from talking with the person directly, from an astrologer, let's say a relatively well-trained astrologer, talking with the client and talking them through their chart and drawing out some of those nuances and details directly. So I've actually thought about redoing some of those interviews for like a workshop or something, where I actually talk to and interview those people directly for like, let's say 45 minutes, and then record the consultations, and then have that as something that people can listen through separately in order to get a deeper understanding for how these people actually experience their Saturn returns.
Oh yeah, that's a brilliant idea. You really, really, you know, totally resonate with the idea that the case study, right? I think the problem with the case study is it's like describing the scent of the soup that you just made rather than letting somebody taste it. Right. But I think, you know, that also just two little thoughts come up while you were saying that. And one is that it's also tough to create the environment of an actual, you know, animate, dynamic astrological experience for others when there's too much artifice. Like, right. You know, telling people they're going to come into a class where they're going to be observed, I have experienced that people are not always natural, or they're, you know, they seem to hold back a little bit more, or whatever. And the other thing is that the other thing that is very, you know, astrology can be very therapeutic. The privacy, the anonymity, there is an alchemy that's occurring. Even if we don't think of ourselves as therapists, there's still, you know, it's like the alembic and keeping a tight lid on it so that the cooking of the thing inside can happen. So I guess I don't mean to be so cavalier about it, but at least my thought is that there should be some way of bringing the us magicians in training into that inner sanctum of the experience itself. If we could try to do that more in thoughtful ways, because, you know, I fear that if there's none of that, then it collapses into the extremes that I was mentioning before. But to your point about trying to, you know, reconstruct the experience afterwards, you're totally right that it's difficult to do. And it's also, it just made me think it is difficult to bring people into that experience. You know, even if a person knows they're going to be recorded, you know, sometimes that can be a problem. I haven't noticed it though. Like, enough of the times, if I just say, let's just get into a reading and, you know, are you okay with it being anonymous in front of a classroom? A lot of times people are, and it doesn't really prevent them from being natural. And I would think that your experiences with the Saturn return interviews were similar. Like, I'm sure you actually got some, even though they know they're being recorded, I'm sure that it was able to go pretty deep.
Yeah. I mean, people had written me ahead of time and shared the stories thinking I would summarize it, but there's certainly, I'm sure there's issues where if you tell a person this is going to be recorded and then replayed for an audience later, that sometimes they might be more careful about like what they share, choose to share about their personal life versus don't. And I'm sure that's problematic, but it's still, you know, a whole lot better than just someone else summarizing it later or, you know, any of the other sort of watered down things that you could get aside from talking to the person directly and trying to capture at least some portion of that astrologer client dynamic.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
I mean, the other thing that comes into play here that I was reminded of recently is, you know, there's a real difference between, it was something I was thinking about recently about the idea of like wisdom that comes through experience and that can only come through time. And it's because I've been thinking a little bit lately after having some different discussions and arguments and sometimes like, tensions with some younger astrologers or students or people that are newer to astrology. One of the things I've been reflecting on recently was, it's an idea actually, you know, several years ago that Stephen Forrest gave a talk on this at like a Norwalk or something. But, and it's something that I would never have accepted when I was an astrologer in my early 20s, but there's a difference between reading like a text of delineations, like let's say Rob Hand's, you know, Planets in Transit that gives some great modern delineations of different transits and sort of knowing theoretically what something like a Saturn return could coincide with or indicates sort of abstractly versus yourself going through that transit and having like a really sort of intense, intimate experience and developing a very intimate understanding on a personal level of what that transit is actually all about. There is actually a difference between the sort of abstract or theoretical understanding of something that you can get from a book or from, you know, a lecture or something like that versus the more experiential understanding of going through it yourself or seeing other people you know closely go through it. And that's one of those annoying things that unfortunately you can only really get sometimes with time and experience and being in the field for a while and through picking up and observing some of those things firsthand as they're happening real time. And you can sort of observe the nuances and details that are happening that go along with that. And that's something I've had to like begrudgingly accept as I've gotten more and more into my career as an astrologer that I would have been much more reluctant to accept early on.
Yeah, right. I think, yeah, that makes so much sense because it's, In some ways, even you and I in our 30s or whatever, we're like young pups, really. I mean, who have yet to see the Uranus opposition, who have yet to see, you know, a lot of different transits. So you live the more that, you know, it's very Saturnine in a way. It's like, time does sometimes really just equal wisdom.
Yeah. And I think that was actually like Stephen Forrest, like the title of his talk, because he was just finishing up his second Saturn return or something like that. And it was about like Saturn and wisdom, or the wisdom that comes through age or experience. And, you know, I say that it's something that I begrudgingly accepted, because I know, you know, if you told me that in my early 20s, I would have told you some not, you know, very nice things. And I would have said, you know, my knowledge of an astrologer, I know plenty about astrology, and I can whatever run circles around you as an astrologer with my knowledge of astrology. But it was largely sort of abstract knowledge at that point that was not grounded in like the experience of having seen a lot of clients, or the experience of having gone through some of those transits or seen them happen in real time myself. And, you know, that's actually one of the reoccurring themes then, even in our discussion here, which is this idea of sort of abstract book learning versus experience, and the challenge that being one of the real challenges for students of astrology, especially newer students of astrology. But the part of the catch that comes along with that is that you don't know that you can't know what you don't know, or you're not going to know what you're missing or what you were missing until you actually have it. So even, you know, somebody telling you that is itself almost like an exercise in just an abstract statement that you can sort of understand abstractly, but you won't fully get until you have that experience yourself.
Yeah, that's really well said. It's sort of like, I think about it, an example that came to my mind when we were talking was, you know, when I first started astrology and I was first starting to see clients, it just seemed like every client that came was holding up a mirror to something happening in my own life.
Right.
You know, and that became like this weird, like, you know, almost like a classroom meme, like, you know, part of doing astrology is that you'll notice that the clients that you attract, you know, this kind of language are always holding up a mirror to you and all the stuff. And I got busy as an astrologer, you know, I started seeing a lot of clients at a certain point. And now I'm like, I don't have time for that. I have no idea if my, like, I'm not relating to my clients in that way anymore. And once in a while, something really profound might stand out, some kind of synchronicity or something. But it's just funny how like a little kernel of what I thought was astrological wisdom about how astrology worked was actually evidence of, you know, being a beginner. And that's how I would see it now.
So you're saying you don't think that that's a continuing trend, but it was just an artifact of you being in your early studies somehow, or what do you mean?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I think that probably, and I don't know exactly why, but probably either the novelty of doing astrology readings for the first time, or something about the insights that you're gaining into yourself and life when you're first doing readings creates the sense that all of your clients are always somehow really resonating with or holding a mirror up to you in your own inner process. But, you know, when I see 30 clients a week, sometimes it's like that magical feeling that every client is somehow, you know, it's kind of blown out of the water by it's like, it's actually just like a full-time job now, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
So I'm not saying it doesn't ever happen, but I'm saying that I think sometimes there's certain like memes that are really pronounced when you first start studying that it's not that they're untrue, but it's that as time wears on, they're also they're not true in the same way or to the same strength or quality that they were when you first began, maybe.
Sure. I feel like I still see, I guess it depends on, I've never like ratcheted up my consultation schedule to like that much to doing 30 in a week. So I don't, but it's like, I feel like I've still seen that as a continuing trend where you'll see certain themes or certain trends that will reemerge over like groups of clients. Like I've had, you know, sometimes you have like two or three clients in a row and they have like the same rising sign or the same Saturn placement. And so you just get like a lesson in like three different instances of that working out and seeing the crossover between them. Or, you know, sometimes astrologers do, I still think that's a sort of relevant thing, whether you're new or not, sometimes can draw certain, you can draw certain placements to you or certain things that you might share in common with your clients. And I often don't know if that's because that's just the type of people that are attracted to you as an astrologer because they like your approach or your style, or if there's something, you know, something else, I don't know, underlying that in terms of however astrology works and the synastry between astrologer and client being one component in however the consultation turns out.
Sure. Yeah. No, that, and that, that's, yeah, I definitely don't mean to be too, I don't know, broad and sweeping about it. I don't see 30 clients would be like, you know, usually like I do New Year's readings and after my Kickstarter is done every year. And then I'm really saturated with readings that I'm doing. And so that's not like a typical week for me, but it is to the point where I do now see hundreds of clients every year. And with that level of clients, I guess, I don't pay attention as much because there's so many or something like that. But my simple point was just that I think, whereas, you know, and I do see, like, you know, especially if I'm studying something, if I'm really studying a method, or if I'm studying, if I have an idea that I'm working with in my craft, then it does feel like the universe sends me three or four charts in a row that really somehow focus and almost teach me something about that method. That definitely happens and stuff like that. I guess what I'm saying is so here's an even simpler example that maybe will be more basic. You know, when you're starting off, and I remember, you know, I would make sweeping generalizations. Like every time I see someone with this sun sign, it's like this, you know, and then, you know, 5 years later, you're like, God, you know, you've seen so much more that the kind of simple generalizations that you think are these profound truths in the beginning maybe are more, a little bit more nuanced and not so easy to generalize.
Sure. Yeah, definitely that process of seeing things in practice and seeing the principles in practice can definitely do a huge number on you in terms of, you know, being a little bit more careful in some of the statements and understanding the nuances and the mitigating factors and other things like that. That's actually been a sort of recurring thing that's come up for me and a few students over the past few weeks, which has been, well, it's not really students, but just I have certain annoyances, and I think it's like a sort of side effect is getting older, but I'm getting, there's like certain things that annoy me more than they used to. And one of those things is like, sometimes when you attempt to like write an article or do a video or teach a principle and you put forward the concept, just the basic concept, let's say a distinction, very often there's always like that one person that has the exception to the rule or has the mitigating factor will pipe up and say, that doesn't work in my chart. And sometimes be very aggressive about saying, this principle that you just taught doesn't work in my chart, before you've gotten to the point of saying, and here are the exceptions or here are the mitigations or what have you. And Right. That's always like, I don't know, do you have that experience or have you had that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of part of the territory of traditional astrology, is that it does attract a certain amount of like fussiness and nitpicking, where, you know, people get into kind of like, you know, peeing competitions about who knows the most obscure, who knows how to spot the instant mitigation to whatever's being said. And I think it makes it challenging for astrologers who are trying to teach people traditional astrology. I've just noticed at times in traditional astrology forums that there's, you know, you're sharing a concept or a chart or something that you did in a chart or how you read a chart, and people are eager to like apply and sort of demonstrate their really technical knowledge and stuff like that. And it's sort of annoying because you it's a feeling like it stalls the process of actually elevating or building some kind of resonance of success with the method.
Right. Well, and it's also this additional issue that's sometimes common amongst astrologers, or there's like certain types of astrologers that have more problems that with it than others. Although on some level, maybe at different points in our career, we all fall victim to it. But it's that, I tried to summarize it last week into like a principle or a statement, but it was basically what I said was, when you reject an astrological technique or conclude that a technique is not valid, be careful that you're not doing so simply out of ignorance of how the technique in its entirety actually works. So sometimes when you're learning something new, and you start applying it and you find some exception, or it's not applying in the way that it's, you think that it's said to, sometimes people will just immediately reject it out of hand, not realizing that there were other factors that they needed to take into account that would allow the technique to work just fine. But they didn't get to the point of really giving it a chance to try the technique in its entirety, but instead sort of rejected it in a cursory fashion before a sort of complete investigation had taken place.
Yeah, that's something going back to the what do beginners possibly struggle with, that I right. would say, for example, that students, when they first learn the language of dignities sometimes, or when they first learn about whole sign houses or something like that. Well, whole sign houses is actually a great example, because that's a sticking point for a lot of my students who are coming from modern astrology. They'll learn about whole sign houses. Something in their chart will switch and they'll say, oh, it's no longer accurate, so I can't use it. And I'm like, well, you have to get through a lot more theory. Like we need to talk about aspects and configurations, and you know, in the Hellenistic terms from your textbook, bonification and maltreatment. Like we need to get through like a lot of things, because probably there's a really good explanation for your experience that's still very discernible within a whole sign chart. But you're not, you know, but the patience may not be there. So rather than understanding entirely all the pieces that may go into delineating their chart, now that it's in whole signs, they'll just, you know, they'll throw it out right away because something doesn't look the same as they think it should. So they say, well, it's not working.
Right. I mean, and the one I've always had the most problems with, or this comes up the most often, is sect. Because when you first teach sect, one of the basic, you know, you have the basic distinction that it's between day and night charts, and that planets function differently based on whether it's day or night. And then by extension, in some instances, you can do things like say that, for example, due to sect, that people who have a day chart, generally speaking, will tend to experience the Saturn return as more constructive, whereas people with night charts can tend to experience it as more challenging or difficult in terms of the spectrum of, you know, constructive versus more extremely difficult significations and manifestations. And, you know, you'll introduce that as a basic distinction, and then immediately sometimes there'll be a person with a night chart who says, that's not true, or I had a fine Saturn return and it worked fine in my chart, and I didn't have many difficulties or any difficulties during that time, before sort of I've gotten to the point of saying, there are exceptions to this rule, such as if Saturn has dignity being in its own sign or exaltation, or if Saturn is being bonified by a close configuration with Venus and Jupiter. And then it turns out that person did have those mitigations, but never sort of got to the point of that point in the discussion, I guess, basically.
Yeah, of course. And it's really frustrating. I think there are, you know, certain people who are, and not just, you know, in ancient astrology, but all forms of astrology, that they're, I think that there's, sometimes maybe there's some wounding around authority, where anyone tries to present methodology, or this is how it works, or this is what to do, or something like that, that, you know, they ruffle immediately on some level, maybe because they've had bad experiences or something in their life with authority, or they feel that there's something potentially inflexible. They're really sensitive to that. And then, you know, it's like, well, we might as well, so then if the technique that's being explained doesn't line up, it's not just, well, that didn't work, but I wonder if there was something else going on. They'll
right. Is there something I'm missing versus there's something that the teacher is wrong, or immediately jumping to the assumption of the teacher.
That's right. Yeah. So you jump to the assumption that the teacher is wrong. And I think that that's a psychological issue that it just seems to exist. When I've seen that in so many different workshops with astrology.
Sure. That makes sense. Well, and that was something we were going to mention in the last episode I did, where we were talking about, you know, going to conferences and some of the things that you should avoid. And one of the things we wrote down that I don't think we got to was, like, don't be that person that kind of, like, it's the middle of a lecture, you're sitting in the lecture, the person has just taught something, and that you raise your hand and, you know, attempt to say something that completely contradicts what the teacher, what the lecturer is saying, or where you sort of say something that's more like making a statement or a rhetorical statement rather than actually asking a genuine question or something like that.
Yeah. I think that, I've seen that happen so many times. It's true. That's really, it does happen. And it's always, I feel like it's like a particular, like, maybe there's like a science fiction realm where it's actually just one species of creature that are just like taking on different faces, trying to sabotage really otherwise like really enjoyable astrology lectures.
Right.
It's so frustrating when that happens, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely, you're probably right that it's probably, there's some, you know, thing, there's some archetype or there's some psychological thing there, because it seems like it's something underlying that's something in common sometimes. But anyways, so that's sort of vaguely related to, because it's something that I think we could classify under the original question that, as with the last Q&A episode, I've turned the single question into the entire discussion, but I think that's
well,
okay.
We should go forward. We should answer. We should try to do like a rapid fire round where we just, you know, answer it, you know, take three or four more and just give shorter answers. That would be fun.
I mean, it's like Michael asked five. So our first guy has actually a bunch that could carry us through the rest of this episode. And I think that would be okay. There's a second one that we could get to from Cindy, who has some related questions. Maybe if we just did these two, that would be sufficient, because I know we only have, I mean, it depends on your timing, but we've only got like 15 minutes left if we stuck to the original timing.
I think we could go up until 8 my time.
Okay, so like another 30, 35 minutes?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay, so, well, and it's like, I don't necessarily want to leave the topic per se, so let's just see what happens. Because one thing, you know, we're focused on, one of the things we're talking about is we're talking about like teacher student dynamics, and you brought up the idea of lineage and pointed out in the Hellenistic tradition there was like this hermetic succession model, but there's a lot of interesting things like that. But just to answer Michael's original question, one of the answers that I had where he asked, you know, what are the mistakes that most beginners make when they first start to learn astrology, one of the things that I would say is becoming overly focused on minor things that aren't really that important. Like I would, you know, in my personal opinion, I would say things like minor aspects or jumping to asteroids or other things like that before really solidifying their understanding of the fundamentals. I think there's a tendency to do that. So, and sometimes that's easier because, like, if you get your chart from astro.com, you know, it'll list your biquintiles and your septiles and ceiling tiles and everything else. And so the student will have this immediate tendency to want to know, you know, what is this aspect that's in my chart, not realizing that that might not be on the same level as like a, you know, a superior square of like Saturn overcoming some other planet in the chart.
Right.
So I would say that that's one of my, I don't know. I mean, that's going to vary for different people, because there are people where it's like they make their entire career out of what are otherwise, you know, quote unquote minor things. And I know even recently, like Rick Levine, you know, made a post arguing that in his opinion, minor aspects are just as important as major aspects. But I do think it's important for astrologers to focus on the fundamentals first before going off into other areas too much, because sometimes the pull can be really strong to do that. But, you know, ultimately, it's not going to give you as strong of a foundation as you might need later on.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I liken it to, you know, learning tarot. I don't think there's so much, like, if you compare astrology to tarot in some key ways, I think that's the comparisons are really fruitful. Like, when you're studying tarot, you know, some of the very, what are the first things that you do when you study tarot? You understand what the numbers mean. You know, you understand what the different suits mean and what the court cards mean. And you focus on the meaning of the, you know, major arcanas. You know, there's just basic things that you learn. Nobody questions that and says, well, you know, have you learned the, like, you know, super esoteric, like, you know, numerology that's in, you know, within the Kabbalah and like it, of course the realm of tarot is also like, you know, incredibly deep and sophisticated, and it can get really esoteric. Nobody questions that you should still start learning tarot by learning, you know, the basic meanings of the numbers and the court cards and things like that. I think one of the reasons that people have such a hard time with that suggestion in I guess today's astrology is because there's this false, I would call it false belief, that ancient astrology is somehow less evolved, that it's not as open-minded, that it's fatalistic. I mean, we had this talk the last time that I came on, but it, I think it's a rather, it's a set of assumptions about what the fundamentals are. And the idea is that, you know, these asteroids represent evolved consciousness, that the outer planets and minor aspects and all of this esoterica, it represents something fundamentally more evolved. And everyone wants to be a level 10 mystic, you know. So it's to me, that's where the rejection of the fundamentals comes from. I like Rick a lot, and I don't think he's wrong that, you know, for some astrologers, the minor aspects, you know, may work or be just as relevant in their practice as you know, the other aspects. However, when I have really refined I'm at a point right now in my practice where for almost 2 years, I look at the outer planets very briefly, and then I eliminate them from my view when I do a reading. I eliminate aspect lines from the chart, so I don't have any view of the aspect lines or glyphs or anything like that. And I eliminate all asteroids, right? So I'm looking at the traditional seven plus the nodes and sometimes the part of fortune. Those things are little, you know, additions that I've added in. But because I'm at a point now where like I could look at a person's chart and with just the seven planets be hitting the bullseye pretty closely, being able to tell them, you know, maybe what they do for a living or, you know, very sort of specific details about different areas of their life purely through a much more sophisticated understanding of the basics. I don't see modern astrologers at the reading. I've had a lot of readings. That's one thing that I've done a lot of in my spare time is getting readings from different astrologers. And especially when I first started, I never saw a lot of modern astrologers who used aspects and, you know, minor aspects and asteroids and stuff like that, doing anything but to utilize the aspects and minor aspects and asteroids and stuff like that to regurgitate cliches. But you know, some of them were interesting, but no one was speaking very specifically to me about, you know, my fate or my destiny. I'm sure that Rick would have done a better job. I didn't have a reading with him, but yeah, so I have the same beef. I think it's like that attention to, you know, paralysis by analysis, either that or it becomes, I don't mean to sound too curmudgeonly, but I just think that a lot of bad astrology is done by incorporating way too much.
Sure. Well, that brings up some of the other questions that Michael, our first questioner, asked. So I'm just going to read them off really quick because we've all already sort of touched on some of the answers, but that might help us focus as we're sort of winding this discussion down. But so his other questions in order were, what are your core principles when you interpret a chart, and where does construction of delineation come in? Question two or three was, what do you believe a consultation should look like and what purpose it should serve for the client? Question four was, what 20% of astrological tools and techniques should I focus on to cover 80% of the tasks of an astrologer? And then finally, the last two questions were, what basic skills do you expect someone to possess before, this is directed at me, what basic skills do you expect someone to possess before taking your Hellenistic course, and what is the best way to acquire them? And then finally, who are the best astrologers you know, and how did they develop their practice?
Yeah, those are all really good questions.
Yeah, well, and they're kind of tied in. I mean, we've already actually touched on, or we started to touch on some of them, even though we hadn't brought them up yet, but just naturally with some of the previous things that led to them.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go through mine. This will be fun. Core principles. I can do this really quickly. I think actually we're probably in agreement, as I'm seeing maybe some of your answers in our shared notes. I think core principles for me are, well, I always start with, talk about what a client consultation looks like. This will be easier. I always start with, is this person coming to me for what type of reading? If they're coming for a general consultation, like a first birth chart reading, then I look at the sect light. I look at the luminary that's not of the sect in favor. So I look at both lights. And then I look at the ruler of the ascendant, and I focus on any angular planets in angular houses. And that usually, being able to break that down for somebody step by step, I have a method that I use that kind of helps me tell a story with the sun, the moon, the rising, and any angular planets. And I use the same method with that every single time. It takes me about an hour. And then there's maybe some time for conversation at the end, or I have a 90-minute session where we go through that in the first 60, and then I do the highlight of the major transits in, say, the next 6 months or year, something like that. If somebody's coming for a topical reading, then I use a totally different approach. If someone's saying, I want to know about relationships, or I'd like to know about this or that, I'm always careful to let people know what I can or can't do in an hour or in 90 minutes. But let's say they want to talk about relationships and money. Okay, I can spend half of a 60-minute session talking about relationships and the birth chart, and 60 or 30 talking about, money or something else, whatever. And then topically, I'll look at the ruler of a house, the planets in the house, any planets that may naturally represent the topic, and try to see what seems to emerge most clearly or definitively, most concretely. Those are the kind, just briefly, like if someone wants to come in for a more universal conversation or a more topical conversation, that's always going to shape, what I do. And if I can, I think, what you mentioned this too, Chris, is giving insight within whatever topics we're talking about in either a natal universal reading or more topical specific reading, giving some sense of that, past transits that may have activated that, that topic or the themes that you're talking about, and hopefully some insight into what's going on now or in the future if there's time. But I do have a reading where basically I just read a person's birth chart for an hour, because I found that, it really takes me about 90 minutes to be able to do a nice reading of the chart plus forecasting.
Sure. And I mean, that really gets to the heart of one of his later questions, which is, what do you believe a consultation should look like, and what purpose should it serve for the client? And my answer to that is that it's almost not possible to give a definitive answer to that for me, since every client wants something different, and each astrologer may not offer necessarily what a given client needs, in which case sometimes you need to refer them out to somebody else, or you need to adjust whatever techniques you're using depending on what their focus is. But that, sometimes even the focus of a consultation really depends on what the person wants to talk about in terms of the three times, which are, past, present, and future, because sometimes the client wants insight into the past. Other times the client wants insight into things that are going on in the present, and other times they want insight into something that's happening in the future. And you might use different approaches for those three. You might use different techniques depending on what topics the person wants to focus on, if it's like career or relationships. I mean, it's hard to answer that. I know there's other astrologers. Like if I was like a psychological astrologer or something like that, I feel like I could probably articulate, like, this is my, answer to what every client should get out of a consultation, which should be like, healing or psychological understanding or something like that. But it's hard to answer that question because clients want different things or expect different things out of a consultation.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think my own perspective is probably, in terms of what purpose should it serve, I think there's a, first of all, I think you can, as an astrologer, it's important to define what you think what the purpose of astrology is.
Right.
And I think, you know, astrologers are also going to define that differently. I know for me at the beginning of a session, I always tell people, you know, here's a little astrology 101. This is why I practice astrology. This is why I think we do astrology. But there's no way in which the reading ends up, you know, having to force that conclusion on the person. For me, the purpose is in line with my, my basic, I guess, well, my wife and I own a yoga studio. I'm definitely on a very sort of particular lineage that I study from Indian philosophy and yoga. So, and I have also a kind of contemplative Christian background. So those things come together. I would say for me, the purpose of a reading from that perspective is to, encourage a person to get to know their karma, their fate, their destiny. So specifically so that they can draw a distinction between their eternal spirit soul and the material incarnation that they're living. So I think the purpose of doing all this is not so much, you know, to empower people to become more conscious, not so much so that they can create some kind of great material outcome with their consciousness, but so that they can respond to their fate, karma, and destiny in a way that starts to facilitate liberation over the course of, you know, their lifetime or many lifetimes. And that's a part of yoga philosophy in some ways that's similar to the philosophy of evolutionary astrology, but it's also quite a bit different in some key ways. But that I tell people at the beginning of a reading, so a simpler version of that, I just say, I want this, my hope is that by getting to know your destiny, in this lifetime, that you will be able to meet that destiny, respond to that destiny with a deep level of acceptance, whether it's good or bad, and not be getting yourself lost in attachment to the ups and downs of life, which from my perspective is the source of suffering.
Sure.
But that's like, I think the point is though, that I really actually really agree with you, Chris, is that different clients will have different needs and different astrologers will have different beliefs about what astrology's purpose is. And certainly I think it's possible to really have a defined sense of purpose as an astrologer and to recognize that the needs and purposes of your clients without, feeling like anyone needs to get really rigid about anything.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest thing is just that different clients are going to come to you with different philosophical and religious backgrounds that may or may not be in alignment with your own as an astrologer. So I guess the most general statement I could make is just that the purpose of an astrology consultation for me as the astrologer is to give the client a greater sense of perspective on their life, both in terms of the past and the present and the future, and a greater sense of like meaning and purpose and overall sort of order and structure to understand some of the underlying themes in their life that play out during the course of the past, present, and future. And then, you know, what they choose to do with that or what they choose to walk away from that with is kind of up to them. Because even that's something that's, you know, hugely debated amongst astrologers, which is, you know, what are the implications of astrology and what does it mean that any of this works?
Right.
You know, the ultimate question is that like astrologers don't know, none of us know. We all have different speculations and we all have different inferences that we've drawn from the fact that astrology works. But like the biggest thing that's weird about the astrological community is that it's almost like this alien technology that this like fringe group of people in society found and have been trying to understand and work with, but don't really fully comprehend and often get the sense that they're only scratching the surface of what it's capable of. And then we all draw sort of different conclusions about what its existence actually means for the world and for the universe and fate and everything else.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I probably take a little different take on it, but I think probably our views are more compatible than not. Because I also believe that there's I feel like as much as I'm ecumenical, you know, like have had a nice liberal arts education and want to be very careful to, respect that there are different beliefs and different paths out there. I also believe that there's a potential dogma or philosophical commitment in saying that none of us know. So I my own personal belief is that there's no way of getting off the hook, that even I don't know eventually left to the unconscious becomes a part of what we end up having to explore. But that belief that I have comes from the commitment of my own philosophical position. So,
right. So. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I'm just saying, it's like, I do have certain fixed philosophical positions. Like one of the things, but I acknowledge that I've run into debates where even things that I think are evident or clear conclusions that one could draw, other people would object to or have objected to. Like, right. For example, one of the conclusions that I draw from the fact that astrology works as well as it does, and the fact that like your transits and your time lords and everything else is something that's baked into your birth chart from the moment of birth. And therefore, with a lot of these traditional techniques, we would make the same statement if we were making predictions about the person, you know, after the first day where they were born, as we would say when they were 35 or something like that, that your career peak periods are going to happen in this decade, your relationship peak periods are going to happen in this decade, you're going to have this transit when you're 35, and so on and so forth. And so, I mean, one of the philosophical conclusions that I often draw from that is there's a greater underlying sort of matrix of meaning and purpose and fatedness to people's lives than we realize. And to me, I take that fatedness as something that's means that there's a greater sense of like meaning and deliberateness and purposeness in the world, rather than the opposite view, which I think is like the prevailing view in the sort of materialistic, sort of almost like sort of like scientific atheist version of the cosmos, which is just that everything is completely random. You know, there's no meaning and purpose to anything that happens in the universe, and we're sort of like specks of you know, mold that are flying around on a rock in the middle of space. Right. And we just have to deal with that and accept that. And the astrology, to me, one of the conclusions I draw is that it's almost like the opposite, that there's some sort of underlying sense of meaning and purpose to people's lives. And you can see that the astrology is sort of reflecting that by indicating things that will happen in their lives from the moment of birth. But I know it's like Lisa and I have had like sort of debates about this, because she's pointed out, or at least she's argued, that you can't necessarily draw that conclusion that just because the astrology works, that it means that the universe is meaningful or purposeful. And so I know that even that's something that's up for debate.
Yeah, that's right. I usually go the other way around. I say the universe is meaningful and purposeful, and therefore astrology exists.
Okay.
I'm just teasing. No, I think that going back, I guess, to, you know, tying a little bow around this piece would be back to what you originally said, which is that it's important to ride the line or hold the tension between serving your clients and holding space for the diversity of beliefs and religious backgrounds and so forth, while right. also trying to cultivate some of your own conclusions. Because I do think that we come to conclusions as astrologers, and they may not be the same, but those conclusions, we make them conscious and clear to ourselves, maybe to our clients, maybe not. I think it's important. And I also think it's important, like amongst ourselves, that it not be taboo to allow our beliefs about what astrology is or does, or its purpose, that there should be allowance for like healthy competition. It shouldn't be, you know, dogmatic fundamentalist, rejections, and, you know, this just severity around it is too much. If it's like that, it should, you know, we should be able to have conversations with each other.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. That makes sense. So let's see. So we sort of talked about what are the basic techniques and tools. I mean, you gave your answer. I would just say, you know, that the 20% of astrological tools and techniques that you need to focus on to cover 80% were basically the things you mentioned. And I mean, that list for me is just like sect, the basic significations of the planets, benefic and malefic, dignity, houses and their rulers, transits, perfections, and maybe like zodiac releasing. And that covers 80% of the tasks that an astrologer will have, since most tasks that astrologers are asked about are, you know, natal related or related to natal astrology.
Yeah, that's totally. And I would almost say that one of the most important things for me, and I would put almost at the top of the list, would be really understanding the house topics, really understanding the matrix of house topics and how they're related, and also the planetary planetary like sympathies and antipathies, you know, like sort of understanding this is really what you meant when you said dignity, I'm assuming, but like that understanding the, you know, some of those passages, I don't remember if it's Antiochus or where it's from, but it's, you know, the planetary contrarieties and on exaltations and depressions, like that little section is so, do you know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's in Retorius.
Right. So that section, super helpful in terms of understanding how planets get along with each other and how, why some of these dignities exist. So I would almost say like utilizing those concepts, but understanding some of the inner logic of them, some of the inner, like the, some of the symbolic rationale that, you know, it appears is behind the use of certain topics. I found that having that is a bit like having a skeleton key. It gives you the rule or the basic concept, but it also teaches you how to use them in lots of different situations.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and once you do learn those basic ones, you can also apply them to other branches of astrology, like electional or horary, where there can be a lot of interchange between at least basic concepts.
Yeah, like I think of a really basic one, like, you know, why is a moon in Capricorn in its detriment or in its exile or something like that? And if you understand, well, because it's in the sign of Saturn and the lights have natural opposition to Saturn, Saturn is represented to darkness and mortality, and the lights are related to like life. If you understand those things, I feel like that underlying almost like archetypal rationale informs your use of the concept of, you know, moon and Capricorn and its detriment in a way that, you know, it's that kind of fundamental, I guess, that I'm really most interested in.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And that was something we really focused on and drew out last weekend when I did a webinar for the Hellenistic course, where we went through and read some of the Hellenistic delineations of like planets and signs. And when you do that, when you read Dorotheus or Manetho, or to lesser extent Firmicus, you see that almost all of the delineations are largely about, you know, what is the meaning of the planet, and then what is the meaning of the planet that is the ruler of that sign, and then, you know, what happens when those two planets come together, or when you blend those significations, and then you realize that that's really the core of the dignity and debility schemes, which is just how does the guest planet get along with the host planet whose sign it's staying in. And then by extension, you realize why it's good for a planet or auspicious for a planet to be in its own sign, because it's a sign in which it doesn't have to rely on any host planet to provide it with additional modifying significations.
Yeah, exactly. I think we'd probably agree then that it's these basics like sect and dignity, house and house rulers. The list that you mentioned was so spot on. It's also, we would add to that, that it's really trying to understand the basic inner logic of those concepts, because they teach you how to use them as well.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And but then again, just circling back to earlier topic, that's also one of those things that it's like you need to get those basics down to understand the theoretical structure of all of this, but then you have to actually start doing it in practice. And it's through observing things happening, especially it's good to research things in the past. And I think that's really important. Like, if you want to know what Saturn in Capricorn is going to be like, going back and researching other times that Saturn has been in Capricorn, or people that have Saturn in Capricorn in their charts. But what's most illustrative is watching the things happen live in person. And so, for example, that's why I wanted to do the Saturn in Sagittarius retrospective, because it's been really interesting watching some people going through those Saturn returns over the past 2 or 3 years, or even just watching world events. Where, you know, as you know, somebody that writes about mundane events regularly, it's been, some of the manifestations have been surprisingly literal of Saturn in Sagittarius, but that in and of itself has been really useful and instructive. And I think all astrologers have, you know, learned some additional things about that placement just as a result of watching that transit happening contemporaneously.
Yeah. Yeah. Really well said.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of our time here. So once again, we got through one person. Mike, thank you to Michael Beeson for submitting the questions.
Who are the best astrologers that we know? We should say that real quick.
You know, I don't even know. I can't even answer that question just because there's different astrologers that specialize in different traditions who I would say are my favorites or who I think have done some of the best work. But whether that qualifies, you know, what do you mean by like best astrologer? Really is a tricky thing.
I like, I mean, for modern, I really like, I'll just say it real mine really quick, just in case anyone cares. I like Liz Green for psychological and Richard Tarnas for archetypal. These are obviously masters. I like Stephen Forrest and for evolutionary, I think is great. I like Chris Brennan, Dimitri George, Joseph Crane, Ben Dykes, John Frawley, Robert Schmidt, Robert Hand for traditional. I think those are like my favorite traditional folks. And that's my answer. But there's so many. Those are just some of the ones that I really love.
Sure. I mean, I'd say, you know, Geoffrey Cornelius for the philosophy of astrology.
Brilliant.
It's hugely important. Hand's work, Planets in Transit, is still one of the defining works on modern astrology and modern transit theory. And that's, I really think one of the big reasons why Rob Hand is so important or seen as so important is because of that book that he wrote in the 70s. Howard Sisportis was really good for psychological astrology. I was reviewing some of his work recently, like his work on the houses or on the outer planets called The Gods of Change.
That's a great book. I remember that one.
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, and I could go through the list, you know, Dimitra, of course. Tarnas's book is a great summation. I feel like of that certain trend of modern astrology, that Tarnas's book was the high watermark of that. And it's going to be interesting in retrospect because it was written right at the end point before the traditional thing really started getting big. So you're going to see this interesting thing where Tarnas's book is probably going to be one of the last major summations of like late 20th century astrology before the traditional material started infusing and making its way into, you know, contemporary modern Western astrology, where, you know, now all of a sudden, like everyone's using whole sign houses, which just blows my mind from the perspective of knowing what the community was like 10 years ago, where less than 5 or 10% of people even knew what that concept was.
Right. And I think I just had Becca, Richard's daughter, come and speak at Nightlight. And she is really, really interested in bringing more of the, you see, one of the things about, people may know this, is that about archetypal astrology is that one of the hallmarks of archetypal astrology, the way that Tarnas practices it, is it's primarily a study of like wide orbed outer planetary interactions in relationship to mundane world events. And Becca, and part of the reason for doing that was to, you know, basically bring astrology into a sort of academic respect, you know, so he didn't involve signs, houses, things like that. Becca is now the editor of Archi at California Institute of Integral Studies. And I think we both were talking with her at NORWAC, Chris, about, you know, traditional astrology. And I think she's, you know, carrying the mantle of her father's work in many ways and has a real interest in trying to bring in topics of houses, signs, traditional historical developments in astrology into the work of Archi, at least, which is really interesting because that journal is sort of, in many ways, the standard bearer of his work. So maybe, you know, Becca and other people coming out of CIIS, which is like his, sort of his astrological legacy, will be interested in this crossover. I imagine that there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, definitely. And I have been interested, and I'm planning on doing an interview with Becca and Grant, who are the editors of Archi now, when their next issue comes out, which shouldn't be too long now, I think.
I'm submitting an article on the houses for them for that. And I know that they're like gathering she's writing her dissertation right now on Tolkien and Jung. So I know that, you know, that process has slowed down their own process with the latest edition. But anyway, I just think it would be, I think that's one way in which maybe the Tarnas legacy of Cosmos and Psyche it may evolve through his own daughter's work.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And therein, that's partially what's interesting is just, that's why I was saying, and that's why I think, you know, Tarnas's work might end up being that last summation of modern astrology, because I think it's going to be really hard at this point for all of the different schools going forward to operate independently from each other without any sort of crossover or without any influencing of each other, even sometimes in very small or very minor ways. But the fact that you have, like, you know, evolutionary astrologers that are using whole sign houses, or like psychological astrologers that are talking about sect or the joys or other things at that point, means that this revival of traditional astrology is like seeping into other fields and therefore almost contaminating them in a way, so that you won't have just like these pure sort of isolated traditions anymore before too long.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully they're enlightening them and not just giving them a cold.
Right. Yeah. And affecting them with, deterministic astrology. I don't know. We'll see. We'll have to make that the topic of the next episode.
Right on.
So, all right. Well, I know we're out of time at this point, but thanks a lot for joining me for this discussion today. I have no idea what to title this. Do you have any suggestions about titles for this episode? What was our underlying theme and like topic? It ended up being spin-offs from the initial question, which was, you know, what are the mistakes that most beginners make? But it turned into something more about like education and teaching and students and things like that.
Yeah. I think a great title would probably be the first question. What are the mistakes most beginners make when they start to learn astrology? And then maybe like a subline and other interesting conversations, you know?
Right. Right. All right. I'll think about that and see what I come up with. Anyway, thanks a lot for joining me. Where can people find more information about your work?
Oh yeah. Right. So, you can check out my work at nightlightastrology.com. And I'm on Facebook at Adam Mellenboss.
Awesome. Excellent. Well, everyone should check out your website. Thanks a lot for joining me again today. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.